This week on Making Contact.
I think it is very important to recognize the extraordinary sacrifices and heroism of these individuals who often risk their lives.
Doing what's right and being punished for it is much better than spending the rest of your life in this system.
Resistance to the status quo is a common theme among social, political, and environmental movements. But resistance during war can increase the stakes, sometimes with dire consequences. On this edition, we'll take a look at resistance in Rwanda during the nationwide call for genocide in 1994, Japanese-American activism during World War II, and the legacy of draft registration resistance and conscientious objection since the Vietnam War. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. It's been 10 years since almost a million Rwandans were killed during the genocide that started in April 1994, when extremists from the Hutu majority attempted to wipe out the Tutsi minority. Since then, attention in Rwanda has been focused on dealing judicially with tens of thousands of alleged genocide perpetrators, or what Rwandans called genocidaires. Yet there were people who resisted the genocidaires and risked their lives to save Tutsis. Some were killed as a consequence of their courage by the extremist Interahamwe militia, which was one of the main instruments of the genocide. Others survived. Correspondent Rupert Cook reports from Rwanda.
Mu kwezi kwa kane niho ba bisha abantu bakora uko bashoboye.
Sula Karahimbi is an elderly widow in her early 90s. Here she describes how in April 1994, at the beginning of the Rwandan genocide, she made her house a sanctuary for some 54 Tutsis who would otherwise have been almost certainly killed by Hutu extremists intent on genocide. Sula's house and compound take up around 35 square meters. It was here that she hid her Tutsi neighbors under beds and tables, despite repeated visits and threats from Interahamwe militia, army, police, and presidential guard.
Baba gari bench. Nabaje pebaraje, baba yuko, baba gira.
As a traditional healer, Sula was able to use her reputation for magic to intimidate the genocidaire and protect the Tutsis who'd sought refuge with her. Marie is a 65-year-old Tutsi. Her husband and almost all her immediate family were killed during the genocide. She herself only escaped thanks to Sula's courage in hiding her.
Zura. Zura no muvandimwe wanje tubana neza nkuko kera byari biri.
Sula is like part of my family. You have seen her bravery and everything that she did to allow me to continue to live here. And whichever one of us dies first, the other one will bury her. That's what I can say about Sula.
Sula is one of a relatively small number of Rwandans who demonstrated extraordinary courage during the genocide by offering sanctuary to Tutsis who were being hunted by the genocidaire. The sheer scale and intensity of the genocide, in which almost a million people were killed in just over 3 months, indicates the level of social control and organization employed by the genocidaire. The fear of retribution for hiding Tutsis deterred many. The Reverend Celestin Hatigmana is a member of the Anglican clergy. A Tutsi, he and his wife were also among those saved in 1994.
They feared because there are some persons who were killed for hiding other persons. There are many examples in Rwanda. For example, in the Anglican church, we have a pastor in Ruhanga parish in Kigali Rural. He has been killed with his family because he was with many people. When the killers came, they killed Tutsis. In the same time, they killed the pastor with his family. So for that, many persons feared.
Damas Gasimba was, in April 1994, running an orphanage in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. At the beginning of the genocide, he had under his charge 65 children, both Hutu and Tutsi. Despite repeated threats and raids by Intrahamwe militia, he made the orphanage a sanctuary for all those at risk. Approximately 400 orphans, refugees and employees survived the 100 days of genocide, largely thanks to the efforts of Damascus Imba.
I really wasn't afraid during the genocide. The fear came after it was over. But during the genocide, I felt that if I was going to die, I should die with everyone else, because everyone was dying. I saw people dying here, just on the road. I saw others being taken to communal graves. So I said to myself, I'm like the others, and if this is the time to die, one should die. I wasn't afraid. Tomorrow, it will be someone else. Yesterday, it was someone else. Tomorrow, it will be me. It was like that.
Hier, c'était l'autre. Demain aussi, c'est moi. Donc, c'est comme ça, ouais.
It's difficult to generalize about why certain people, and not others, showed such extraordinary courage during the genocide. However, there seem to be some common factors. Elizabeth Onyango is the program coordinator in Rwanda for the human rights organization African Rights, which has worked extensively with genocide survivors since 1994.
Sometimes it's a difficult question to answer because it's a very personal one. A lot of them had this feeling of a sense of duty, a sense of responsibility, respect of life and dignity of other people. For most of them that we talk to, God plays a big part of the picture. So whether it is the belief that God is the one that did it through them, or whether it is God that gave them the strength to do it, he definitely plays a part. You also have to add into that maybe the principles you find around that, or around religion in general. Principles of humanity, respect for life, for dignity, those definitely play a part, however well articulated or not they are.
Damas Gasimba from the Gasimba Memorial Center Orphanage.
Il y avait des gens comme moi qui voulaient, donc tout au début, tout le monde voulait un peu essayer de sauver son ami, son voisin.
In the beginning, everybody wanted to do a bit to save their friend or neighbor. But it wasn't like that later on. The genocidaires really had the means to eliminate people as they had planned. Then they said, if you are caught with someone, you will die with them. For me, there were already 100 or so staying here. So if one was going to be killed for hiding one person, I already had 100. There was no way to ask 100 people to leave. So I decided that if it were necessary to die, we were going to all die together.
Almost a decade has passed since the genocide. Yet, despite Rwanda's attempts at reconciliation, among some, there remains a strong antagonism towards those who saved Tutsis during the genocide. At the beginning of 2003, just after a widely publicized ceremony in Kigali honoring Sula's courage, unknown arsonists attempted to burn her alive in her house.
All my possessions, all my books and money were burned. When I cried out for help, someone heard me and came to put out the fire. It's because of this fire that I have decided to have nothing to do with people who are really my enemies. One of the people whom I helped during the genocide came back to repair the house, but we are still missing some materials.
Although the attack on Sula's house probably illustrates the continuing fault lines in Rwandan society, commentators like Rakia Omar, the director of human rights organization African Rights, hope that highlighting those who risked their own lives to save people during the genocide may contribute both to reconciliation in Rwanda and to a broader message beyond.
I think it is very important to recognize the extraordinary sacrifices and heroism of these individuals who often risk their lives, and many of the individuals that we know made extraordinary efforts died along with the people that they saved. When one talks about Africa, there is this kind of mass of negative impressions. There is this idea that we are all victims and perpetrators, and there's nothing in between as far as African masses are concerned. But since their heroes are there, they exist and they should be recognized, and that recognition can hopefully tame the evil in others by making them recognize that inflicting suffering is not the only way forward. There are also many other people that you can emulate that who do good and who collectively therefore lift the dignity of Africans. So I think as an African, I have a responsibility to work in that field as well.
For Making Contact, I'm Rupert Cook in Kigali, Rwanda.
In the United States, 2004 marks the 60th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Korematsu ruling, which allowed a group of citizens to be singled out and expelled from their homes and imprisoned for several years without trial based solely on their ancestry. 2004 also marks the anniversary of lesser-known cases of resistance from the United States' World War II Japanese internment camps. Correspondent Robin Takeyama has more on the Japanese-American draft resistors.
Complying with government orders is generally considered the patriotic thing to do, especially during times of war.
Free! Free Stephen Falk! No! Incarceration! Free!
But Marine reservist and conscientious objector Stephen Funk follows a long line of resistors imprisoned for opposing the government.
Doing what's right and being punished for it is much better than spending the rest of your life in this system doing something that you found out was wrong.
When Japanese Americans were relocated to World War II internment camps and then received draft orders, some resisted. To protest in this wartime climate, they risked unknown consequences, both from the government and from within their own community.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack.
When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the United States was in shock, and war hysteria fueled the existing anti-Japanese sentiment.
Every time we went downtown or anything like that, we were really discriminated against, you know. My mother, she's got to buy something, school clothes for the kids and stuff. She used to stand there for hours and nobody would serve her, you know.
Japanese Americans like San Jose native Mitz Koshiyama braced themselves for the backlash.
Oh, it was very difficult times. I couldn't describe it to you. It's just fear and fear of the unknown.
Then on February 19th, 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, initiating relocation of all Japanese Americans living on the West Coast to 10 guarded relocation centers in some of the country's most undesirable land. The Japanese American Citizens League, or JACL, an organization of Japanese Americans born in the United States, did what they thought was best for the community and assisted the government with the relocation process. A handful of Japanese Americans challenged the curfew or relocation orders. One of the four major legal test cases of the internment era was initiated by Fred Korematsu, who violated the exclusion orders. He was arrested and later found guilty by the United States Supreme Court. However, most others, like Koshiyama, suppressed their outcry.
Our leaders decided that the best course to take was to accept the racism, you know, and cooperate with the government, even though they're telling lies. And I said, this is wrong, but here I'm just in high school yet, and I didn't want to make it bad for my parents.
By August 1942, the Western Defense Command completed the relocation of over 110,000 Japanese Americans. After Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were reclassified as 4C, enemy aliens ineligible for the draft. In the hopes of improving their public image, the JACL urged Japanese Americans to volunteer for segregated combat groups. Ernie Ayama from Topaz Relocation Center was one of 1,200 volunteers from the camps.
I was one of those that believed that this was a war that we had to fight, you know, that we had to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese Imperial Army, because otherwise, if they won, we would be worse off than we were.
In addition, 10,000 Japanese men from Hawaii, where relocation did not happen, volunteered for armed service. Heart Mountain internee Mitsu Koshiyama says he could not overlook the irony of the government and the JACL's request.
JACL says, oh, you got to go prove yourself. How about the Germans and the Italians? Did they have to go prove themselves, you know? It didn't make sense to me. I never did anything wrong, and I said, if they give me my rights as an American citizen, I'll go. That's the only way I'm going to go. I want to be treated like an American, and I want equal rights.
To determine eligibility for military service, all internees over 17 years old had to answer a loyalty questionnaire. Two ambiguous questions generated controversy. Question 27 asked if you were willing to serve in the armed forces wherever ordered. Question 28 asked if you would forswear allegiance to the Japanese emperor. The respondents understood the importance of their answers and tried to anticipate their outcome.
Because it was just a loaded question. In other words, when did you stop beating your wife? If you answer, yeah. Well, either way, you'd be putting your foot in your mouth.
At first, my answer is no, no. And 1 month later, my parents told me, you was born here, you got a right to stay here. And if you no, no, eventually they're going to send us back to Japan, see? So I changed my no, no to yes, yes.
12,000 no-no respondents and their families were relocated to Tule Lake Relocation Center, which was placed under greater security. By January 1944, the government started drafting Japanese Americans from the camps to make up for a low volunteer turnout. Jimmy Yamaichi and 26 others from Tule Lake refused to comply with their draft orders.
We're in the armed guards, the 1,200 soldiers watching us full time, and with the barbed wire, chain link fence and all that, and still going to serve in the Army. This is a tough decision, but you just have to bite the bullets as well. We're already in jail now, so it can't be any worse.
Professor Eric Muller, author of Free to Die for Their Country, says the response at Heart Mountain Relocation Center was more organized.
Heart Mountain was unusual because there was a group of older Nisei, that is to say American citizens of Japanese ancestry, who began speaking publicly in the mess halls about the outrage that was being asked of them to leave a barbed wire enclosure to serve in the U.S. Army. This organization, which became known as the Fair Play Committee at Heart Mountain, was very, very effective.
Despite the War Relocation Authority and JACL pressure, 63 young men at Heart Mountain Relocation Center refused to go to their physicals. The JACL did their best to defuse dissension. Professor Muller found that in some cases, JACL members even helped the FBI by questioning draft resistors in their jail cells to discover their leaders' names. Some of the resistors' charges were dropped, while others spent up to 3 years in jail. President Harry Truman pardoned the resistors in 1947. But whether returning home from a relocation center, a prison, or military service, many like Koshiyama still faced racism.
Naturally, when I came back, I tried to get jobs, but I was refused to be employed. Even though my brother went in the Army, and when he came back, he couldn't even get a job. Nobody's going to tell me that because he went in the Army that he was accepted and stuff like that. Couldn't buy a home.
As a result of a successful community campaign in 1988, President Ronald Reagan apologized for discriminatory wartime actions by the government. But Koshiyama says the rift in the Japanese-American community still lingers.
President Truman's amnesty board gave us a presidential pardon in 1947. JACL didn't apologize for what they did until the year 2000. That's how divided we were. And I say they should apologize also to the No-No people, because they were the real Americans.
Today, Koshiyama encourages the next generation of Japanese Americans, the Sansei, to continue in the draft resistors' footsteps.
I hope that you Sansei learn from this evacuation and incarceration of loyal Japanese Americans that you always have to be on a watch for bigotry and racism and be willing to fight for your rights when that happens.
For Making Contact, this is Robin Takayama.
We'll have more on war resistance in a moment. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD or cassette copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. The large scale and high visibility of protests against the Vietnam War made the public more aware of conscientious objectors and draft resistors. According to the Center for Conscience and War, nearly 200,000 people were granted conscientious objector status during the war, while another 250,000 are estimated to have refused registration. But while the movement's visibility faded with the end of the U.S. presence in Vietnam, active resistance to draft registration continued into the 1980s. Ed Hasbrook was one of 18 people prosecuted in 1982 for refusing to register for the draft. Making Contact's Susanna Hines spoke with Hasbrook, who still is involved with the draft resistance movement.
What was the urgency of suddenly prosecuting you? I mean, why then and why you?
Draft registration was brought back in 1980. It wasn't until 1982 that anyone was prosecuted, mainly because the number of people who had not turned up to register was so much larger than the government had expected and so far exceeded their ability actually to prosecute what was, even from the first initial weeks of mass registration, more than 1 million non-registrants. The strategy that was eventually adopted was to prosecute a small targeted group of organizers, the most vocal non-registrants, on the theory that that would produce the most deterrent effect to other young men who had chosen not to register for the draft. That actually backfired tremendously. And in fact, when they had this brief round of show trials indicting 20 out of the more than 1 million people who hadn't registered, draft registration only went down. And since that wave of show trials, there continues to be widespread resistance to the ongoing legal requirement for young men to register as they turn 18. Continued massive resistance, but nobody's actually been prosecuted, despite a lot of threats, since 1987. Which is a tremendous victory, I think, for war resistance at a time when it's had very little visibility and very little active organizing.
Do you have an idea of what those numbers are as far as people who should have been registered and aren't, and who should be registering and who aren't?
The last time that the General Accounting Office did an audit of preparedness for reinstatement of an actual draft, they found that the Selective Service had current accurate information on less than half of those who would potentially be subject to a draft. So it is clearly at an ongoing level of resistance that is precluding any possibility of reinstatement of a draft.
Where's the motion for this resistance coming from? I mean, I think a lot of people think of it as it's inevitable. You turn 18, you register for the draft.
I think a lot of people, older people in particular, might assume that. But I think it's one of the real differences that I see in the patterns of war resistance from even during the Vietnam War and earlier generations of draft resistors and what's happened since 1980. And it was only a brief five-year period from 1975 to 1980 that draft registration was completely abolished. But that marked a shift from basically a pre-Watergate to a post-Watergate generation of young people. You know, people my age didn't need to be disillusioned about a government that we'd never really had any illusions about. You know, we grew up, came of political awareness during Watergate or since then, and have known of the possibilities for government corruption in America. It's a post-60s generation that I think is intuitively much more skeptical about the government. And for a lot of people of my age and younger, it's not been a question of asking, why should we resist? It's much more a question of, what reason can you show me why I should sign a document, knowing the kinds of things that the U.S. government has done, knowing the kinds of wars that has fought and continues to fight? Why should I sign a document agreeing that I'll fight any war you tell me to? That just doesn't make any sense. So I think there's been a fundamental shift in people's assumptions about obedience to the government that underlies that ongoing massive resistance. In recent years, while there has been this ongoing trend of non-registration, more of that has been people simply ignoring draft registration, perhaps, than making a deliberate choice. On the other hand, there's been an increasing presence of resistance within the military, in the so-called volunteer army. And it's not really very surprising. If people are persuaded to join the military because they believe the rhetoric, either that it's just a job and that they won't actually have to fight and kill and die, or they join the military because they believe the rhetoric that they will be called upon or that their work will be defending the country, and then they're sent to invade some other people with whom they have no grievance. And I think this, again, reflects a very encouraging trend of more and more people not simply placing blind trust in a government, which I think has a pretty bad record of picking and choosing which wars to fight and which sides to fight on in them. Many people, you know, are surprised to hear that it's possible for someone already in the military to apply for discharge as a conscientious objector. I think there has been a point of view that, well, once you've decided to be a soldier, then you have signed up for better or worse, and you have to do whatever you're told. But I think, again, as more and more questions are raised about the history of wartime atrocities, there's more and more recognition that it's important, even for those, and perhaps most especially for those who already are in the military, not to stop asking questions.
Currently, to be a conscientious objector, you can't oppose a single war for a single reason. I mean, so you have to oppose all wars generally. What's your take on this?
You know, there's an argument that there's been a lot of energy that's been, in essence, diverted from opposing the military system into providing this limited option for a small, relatively well-to-do and privileged group of people, but that allows fundamentally the war machine to continue.
That was Ed Hasbrook, a draft registration resistor who spoke with Making Contact's Susanna Hines. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Alice Yang Murray. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or a CD copy of the program Courage Under Fire, Resistance to War, number 1604, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartolone, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, office manager, Brishan McKee, founding director, Peggy Law, senior advisor, Norman Solomon, national advisor, David Barsamian, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.